Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. The Rolling Stones recently marked their 50th anniversary with a new round of interviews and concerts, but largely left out of the celebration was the band's founder. Brian Jones has mostly been scrubbed from the group's official mythology, his legacy reduced to a tabloid-ready death and decades of conspiracy theories. But as author Paul Trinka argues in his new biography, despite his too short, often unhappy life, Jones deserves a better fate in rock history. Trinka is the author of Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones, which is published by Viking, and he joins us now.
Hi there.
How did Brian Jones get his start in music, and where was the genesis of what would become the Rolling Stones?
He started out in his birth town, Cheltenham, which was kind of quite a hotbed of activities, especially in trad jazz, which was the kind of happening live scene in the kind of late 40s, early 50s. And out of that, he evolved an interest in blues, purist blues. So even in 1961, he'd tracked down the work of Robert Johnson, the moment that the Columbia album came out. He'd studied all those tunings and basically was trying to get a blues band together in Cheltenham, and in the end decided to move to London. And he was very much the founder. He advertised for members. He ran the auditions. He handpicked all the musicians. So, when you speak to people like Dick Taylor, the guitarist with the Pretty Things, who was the Stones' first bassist, it was Brian who auditioned him, and Brian who said, yeah, what about switching to bass? Go and get one, you're in the band. And, he had complete control of the band in the early days, and it was his vision, and it was an absolutely unique vision, which was one of American electric blues played for a white audience, which was something that was unthinkable. Most people thought it wouldn't work, it couldn't be mainstream. And those people included Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Alexis Corner, who was Brian's key patron. So really, he was a game changer and a visionary.
You contend that a lot of that's been forgotten because Brian Jones was left out of getting the Jagger Richards songwriting credits. But people you spoke with say he was really kind of ahead of his time in terms of his skill as a musician and his proficiency with guitar before the rest of the band got there, right?
Yeah, he taught Keith Richards open tuning. So Keith, in his own book, it's a really entertaining book, talks for page after page about this open G tuning and how amazing it is and how he was shown it by Ry Cooder in late 1968. And Brian is using that tuning on record. He was using it from 1962. It's on record from 1964. So he taught those guys. He taught Mick Jagger how to play cross harp harmonica. In harmonica, it's strange. You use a key, a fifth up from the nominal key. And all these things were very precious secrets, and Brian was the first guy to unlock them. Once you've been shown, it's easy, but Brian really was the pioneer.
Let's talk a little bit about his family life growing up. Ultimately, he would be thrown out of his parents' house very unceremoniously, and a lot of people traced his later unhappiness to never really being able to connect with his parents.
Well, as a psychological reading, that's got a lot going for it. He did have probably classic low self-esteem because his parents didn't want him to pursue music. They thought of it as a hobby and not a job. They wanted him to get a good middle-class job as a dentist or a vet or something like that. And his father was a smart guy. He worked in the aerospace industry, fairly much at the kind of cutting edge of technology. And his father was quite driven. He was also something of a control freak. Even Brian's school reports talk about the father being somewhat a dominating influence. And, he fled Cheltenham. It was he'd been thrown out by his parents, and he embodied the generation gap, and he really burned his boat, so that was another reason why he had to come to London and form a band.
In terms of the sneer the Rolling Stones would be famous for in later years, as you mentioned, there was a generation gap there, and they were kind of the darker side of the Beatles and Stones. Brian Jones, that wasn't really an act for him, right?
No, Brian was at the kind of dark heart of the Stones. There was something quite selfish about him, and there was something quite dark sexually about him. This is something that even his school friends comment on. the rest of the panel were actually not that dissimilar. You know, there was a lot of sexual rivalry and sexual one-upmanship between the band, a lot of dysfunction, a lot of rifts between them. So that even the Beatles, you had Brian Epstein, who's fairly much ensuring parity between all the members. You know, he made sure that Ringo got a song on every album. And Andrew Oldham, the Stones' manager, he was a great manager. He was the opposite. He practiced divide and rule. He wanted Jagger and Richards to be a songwriting partnership. He wanted two of them because the Beatles had two. You know, Mick Jagger was, you know, he was almost like Andrew's student. So Mick learned a lot from Andrew, and they'd go places together. And, you know, those rifts opened up pretty wide early on. So the dysfunction you can hear in the music, he was there in their personal lives as well, for definite.
It's almost unbelievable for me. When I looked at the Stones concert tickets for their last tour, you could sit in the balcony for $800 a seat. But you trace a lot of the unease in the band and the bad feelings that built up to Brian Jones making an extra £5 a week.
Yeah, he made an extra £5 on their salary of £193 per week. And so these days you'll still find Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, you know, retrospectively resent it. They think it's an outrage. And, you know, I'll leave people to comment on that when you look at the fact they have a bassist on salary, you know, and then Mick Jagger and Keith Richards are worth hundreds of millions. And good for them. You know, they're talented guys, great singers, and a great guitarist, but I guess it's, you know, not unusual with stars. You know, they'll always say in the end they did it all themselves. They deserve all the money. Nobody deserves anything else. You know, nobody deserves any more credit. But really, with Brian, their kind of attempts to airbrush him out of history are almost ludicrous. You know, they're just silly. They're illogical. What they do is like the Shakespeare phrase, they protested too much. You know, their attempts to denigrate Brian actually prove that he was really crucial to the band.
It's ironic, too, because as much as they worked to push him out of the band and ultimately would when he really could no longer function too much in the studio, that absence of Brian Jones just opened up another rift between the two guys who just kicked him out.
Well, it did, yes. I mean, if you read Keith's book and you think of all the kind of hatred almost that's directed at Mick, you know, it's this feud that's been going on for 20 or 30 years. And when you see it in the flesh, you know, if you're hanging out with them, as I've done, you know, it's incredibly dysfunctional and nasty. There's something kind of slightly vampiric about the sexual atmosphere around there as well. And if you think about all that kind of focus and negative energy focused on Brian, you know, it would send you over the edge. And that's not to say that, you know, he wasn't difficult and didn't invite and even deserve some of the treatment. But it's more the fact that all these years on, these people who did these things as kids should really grow up and give Brian, who was the visionary behind the band, give him credit.
And that said, you really don't gloss over the other side of Brian Jones, which was not pretty in this book. You know, he had a lot of different women, and he had a lot of children with a lot of different women. He didn't treat them all well by any stretch. And once you added drugs to the mix, that was not a good combination.
No, Brian was, there was something, you know, sociopathic about his lack of conscience, really. So he was always looking forward to what was happening next and then making promises that he couldn't keep, you know, which is not an attractive quality at all. And he was selfish. Actually, one of the best quotes was given me by Keith Oldham, who was Mick Jagger's friend, and he said, you know, Mick Jagger was actually quite good at being bad. You know, he's good at being devious, and Brian wasn't very good at being devious. You know, he made promises he couldn't keep. He wasn't tough in, you know, when he was in confrontations, he'd kind of back down and then resent it later on. So it's kind of quite a classic psychological study. But out of all of that, you know, we get this great music because Brian gave attention to the band. And that tension, you know, that lasted for a year or two after he left. And obviously, Exile on Main Street, they cut with Mick Taylor, is a good album. But after that, it was fairly much over. And, you know, there's kind of conservatism about the band where they just repeat themselves. And that didn't happen with Brian. You know, he was pushing them forward and putting new stuff into the mix. And that's really what gave them their dark heart. And today's sound, you know, it comes from the Brian era Stones. You know, it comes from his open tunings. You listen to stuff like No Expectations, which is one of the last great tracks he recorded with the band. That helped kick off their whole kind of blues, country rock, roots sound. You know, that was his vision. That's where it that's really where it came from. And, you know, Mick and Keith, talented guys, they took what he'd invented and they took it a lot further probably than he could have done. But nonetheless, he was the one who'd really had that vision and actually introduced this music to the world. Because let's not forget that in the States, people like Howlin' Wolf, you know, Buddy Guy couldn't get on TV. They couldn't really get on the mainstream media. And it was really Brian Jones more than anybody who helped make it happen for those guys. And I had Buddy Guy tell me how it was thanks to Brian Jones introducing Howlin' Wolf on Shindig that those guys crossed a bridge that they thought never would be crossed. So that's really a profound change in the human race, that, you know, in human culture that Brian Jones helped engineer.
And you give us several points that should serve as a legacy for Brian Jones. Unfortunately, I think most people equate him with the 27 Club and a potentially mysterious death in his pool. But you spend the last bit of your book dispelling the various conspiracy theories that have, you know, taken up God knows how many column inches over the years. Yeah,
well, there are discrepancies in your official verdict, but there are a lot more discrepancies and obvious untruths in the conspiracy theories. So they mainly resolve around a dodgy guy called Tom Keelock having claimed to have heard a deathbed confession by another man, you know, and of course, he only surfaced with this allegation after the accused was dead and couldn't defend himself, and there's no corroboration at all. You know, so there's just no real evidence for it apart from one guy who would have done it to make some money and you know, help sell a book, which is really what happened. And actually, when you go back and you look at different people's theories, they all tend to contradict each other. People tend to think that the different kind of murder scenarios reinforce each other. They don't. They're all inconsistent. And there are a lot of books that are frankly ludicrous, you know, with conspiracy theories about people who we know weren't there on the scene, other people who were co-conspirators who couldn't have been there and denied what happened. So, I mean, I didn't want to go overboard because we don't know for certain. You know, it's possible that maybe the guy, you know, maybe there were suspicious circumstances, but there's no evidence. And so, you know, we know what's most likely is the official verdict. And the people who knew Brian, the people who were with him, like Bobby Corner, Alexis's widow, you know, they're certain that he was frail, he was ill. You know, he was very, very much reduced psychologically to a shell. He'd even given up playing the guitar. And I think that's the thing about the murder theories. People want to think that there's a clean ending and Brian would have made it and somehow somebody snuffed it out. And really, a lot of his life force had been snuffed out because he'd been essentially thrown out of the band that had been his life mission. So, you know, it's a sad story. And I'm sure he could have, in the end, you know, recovered if he'd had the therapy that's available to us these days. But really, no, he did. He faded out, I believe, and it's, you know, and that is sad, but it shouldn't really overshadow what he gave the world, which is, you know, he really changed the sound of rock and roll, and he really did make a difference. So I think whatever he'd set out to do, in a way, he had achieved it.
Well, the name of the book is Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones, and we've been speaking with his biographer, Paul Trinka. The book is published by Viking. Just been a pleasure to read the book and ask you about it, so thanks for your time.
I really great to talk to you. Thanks. And there was a very interesting questions, and it is a fascinating subject. So thanks again. I really appreciate it.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.